Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited today because I get to talk to Dr. Diane Winston about her book titled Writing the American Dream: How the Media Mainstreamed Reagan's Evangelical Vision. This book is really interesting, I found. It goes, in some ways, a deep dive into the kind of key years of Ronald Reagan's presidency, and in some ways zooms out and helps us understand what was happening before then, what was happening in all sorts of American society to kind of lead to these key years, these key messages becoming quite so mainstreamed. Diane, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast to tell us about this fascinating book.
Oh, Miranda, I am so thrilled to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm very pleased to have you. Could I ask you to start off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Yes, I'd be delighted to do that. I am a professor of journalism, communications, and religion at the University of Southern California here in Los Angeles. My exact title is Knight Chair in Media and Religion, and that's Knight with a K-N, not an N. I am someone who began her career as a reporter, and I covered religion in those days. And actually, I began in 1983, which is not coincidentally the start of my book. I left reporting after 10 years to go back and get a PhD in religion. And I am someone who for whom religion and politics has been a lifelong interest. And the book really is a culmination of my questions about religion, politics, and news media, and how the three work together.
All right. Well, that background definitely gives me already some additional insight into the book. But of course, I've already read it. So we'll allow now a bit of a highlights tour through it so that listeners can understand some of the key points as well. First off, I wonder, as kind of something of a contextual question, I suppose. Obviously, the book, by focusing on Reagan and the media, is making some arguments about the ways in which Reagan is using the media that are significant, right, worthy of a book. But we do also have in the popular imagination other presidents before Reagan that are also kind of tied to the use of the media, for example, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So could you maybe set the scene for us, the extent to which Reagan's use of the media was significantly different from previous presidents like FDR?
Yes. As you say, Miranda, all presidents are eager to use the media for their own ends, of course, because the American presidency is called the bully pulpit. As a recognition of its strength as a vision setter, as much as a political agenda setter. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was among the first modern presidents to really make use of the media in his fireside chats. These were occasional radio conversations he had with the American public in which he sought to explain his policies and reassure them. Most presidents after FDR were cognizant of using the media as FDR did to cultivate public support and to almost jump over mainstream media insofar as they could directly communicate with the American public. John F. Kennedy cultivated reporters. He lived large and he loved reporters to join him in that grand lifestyle. And so he was able to capture the interest and support of men like Benjamin Bradley of the Washington Post. Nixon was the first president to start a White House communications office. But Reagan and his supporters, his administration, really felt that they did not want to just have a good relationship with the press. They wanted the press to be their mouthpiece and directly and clearly communicate his interests and his policies to the public. So Reagan really did both administratively through having men in his camp think about how do we turn the press into a mouthpiece for us. And also he gave a series of radio addresses as FDR did so he could communicate directly with the public. He did so much more frequently than FDR did. It's interesting also to think about how subsequent presidents have used the press, and I have to look to Trump as either a mastermind in this usage. A mastermind. He took relationships with the public to a greater degree than any other president because of social media. And the fact that he was able to tweet as many as, 1,000 times a day gave him the kind of access to the public, totally skirting any other mainstream media, that proved invaluable to raising his popularity among his followers.
Mm. Already linking from past to very much the near, the present. So thank you for kind of starting us off and giving us that context of Reagan amongst other presidents. Moving then to kind of focus more on Reagan's specific things that he's talking about and that I think we'll go on to talk a bit more about him discussing. There's some key ideas that you have in the book that I want to make sure we understand so that we can understand kind of what he's doing with them. So can you tell us what you mean by an American religious imaginary and lived religion, kind of both in general and maybe a bit about examples that listeners might be familiar with from Reagan's use?
Yes. It's interesting because the term American religious imaginary is nothing that Reagan would have thought of himself, or probably he would not have even understood it. And yet it's so fundamental to the argument I make about his impact on the American public. Now, a religious imaginary is not something that you learn in school per se as a subject, but it comes to us in the stories we tell ourselves, in the media that we watch, in the ideas floating in the ether. And for Americans, fundamental to our religious imaginary is this notion that God chose us as a nation, and that choosing gave us both democracy and freedom. And the American religious imaginary tells us stories, gives us images, provides a common thread that unites all of us in this understanding of being a God-blessed nation. There's not just one religious imaginary, and people don't ascribe and buy into just one. So what I suggest is there is an encompassing religious imaginary, which is based on this idea of the city on a hill. Now, the idea of a city on a hill is from a a 17th century homily that was supposedly given before the Puritans landed. We don't know that for sure. What we do know is that the text in which the homily, the phrase is used, was rediscovered in mid-20th century. And for whatever reason, it struck Reagan. Now, actually, the city on a hill refers to the fact that when the Puritans came here, everybody in the world would be watching this experiment, and we would be judged, or they would be judged, if this wasn't a God-fearing, God-filled country. So it was a warning. Reagan turned it into a blessing by adding the word shining, city on a hill. And as early as the 1960s, he began referring to America as a shining city on a hill, a beacon to the world of God's blessings of freedom and democracy. Now, this is an overarching imaginary that you can buy into whether you're Hindu, Buddhist, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, or atheist and agnostic. That said, different groups also have their own imaginaries. Martin Luther King's idea of a beloved community has been an important religious imaginary for many people of color as well as white people. In the early 20th century, the Jews had a religious imaginary of a golden land. America would be a land paved in gold. Robert Bella, in his work, sociologist Robert Bella, talks about civil religion, which is another kind of religious imaginary. So it's important to note that there are many religious imaginaries, but I'm saying there was a larger umbrella one that Reagan expressed and tapped into. And that was something that allowed him to communicate his ideas of how one lived according to this religious imaginary through his policies and through what people did in their daily lives. And that's what's called lived religion. Lived religion isn't about going to mosque or saying prayers daily or lighting Shabbat candles. It's about the decisions you make in daily life and how you live your life. Do you volunteer at a soup kitchen? Do you send packages to soldiers fighting abroad? Do you vote every day? How you express your understanding of what it means to be a good person and a good citizen through your daily actions. And Reagan helped make that more explicit through policies, through social policies that guided people in certain directions. Is that clear, or is it still a little abstract?
No, I think that's incredibly clear. So thank you for adding that in. It's really, really helpful to understand kind of the big picture side. And it's not just him saying it, it also comes out in these policy related ways. Could you tell us a bit more about kind of where these ideas of Reagan's are coming from? What was happening in American Christianity before his presidency that is sort of in some ways creating the environment for these ideas to be discussed? What is the relationship between Christianity and his kind of campaign politics? What's happening before he gets to that bully pulpit?
Well, there are actually two parts of that question to answer: what's happening in America and what's happening with Reagan. And maybe I'll start with Reagan first, because there's a side to Reagan that most everyday people, much less historians, are not aware of. And that's because I think the press of his time misrepresented him as someone who was not religious, but just using religion to gain more votes. It was commonly said in the press that Reagan probably wasn't as religious as he said he was because he never went to church, as if going to church is a standard for whether a person is religious or not, number one. I make the argument that Reagan was a deeply religious person, and you can see that by looking at his family history, His mother was quite devout. Reagan was always very involved in his church. When he was a young man, he was so involved with the church that many of his fellow congregants thought he was going to become a minister. So there's history to show that Reagan grew up religious and was himself religious. His career trajectory changed from any thoughts of the ministry by the time he got to college and began radio broadcasting. But his commitment to his faith never changed. And when he lived here in Los Angeles, he belonged to a very evangelical church. And although he wasn't someone who came out and talked about his religious feelings on a daily basis, when he ran for governor of California, he was quite explicit about his religious commitments and the fact that he couldn't do what he did if he didn't have a deep faith in Jesus. Now, you could still say that this was all political posturing, but interestingly enough, when Karen Tumulty, an American journalist, was writing a book about Nancy Reagan, she found some of the private letters that Ronald wrote to Nancy's father. Nancy's father was a physician and he was an atheist. In this private correspondence, which obviously Reagan never expected to become public, he says to his father-in-law, who is quite sick and would soon die, Reagan says, and this is not verbatim, but this is the message, the context of the message. He said, "I wish you would come to Jesus. If you don't, you will be in hell forever. I want to be with you in the afterlife. Please reconsider your feelings and think about becoming a Christian." Now, there's no reason Reagan would have written a letter like this unless he felt very passionately about his faith. And so I want to start out a conversation about the religious ferment of the time by noting that Reagan himself was a deeply religious man. And so his encounter with the culture of the times proved world-changing because he was able to ride the wave that was going on in America. That's number one. What was happening in America was a time of great religious ferment. Throughout the 70s, religious institutions began to stop working for many young people. And many young people, whether through the drug culture, the counterculture, the political ferment, became interested in Eastern religions, small group traditions within Catholicism, Judaism, in particular, and Protestantism. The evangelical movement began to gain strength as a political force in the late 70s. Baby boomers who had dropped out and became hippies began to see the hollowness of that life and themselves become convicted as evangelical Christians. The charismatic movement, which is a type of evangelicalism, but is more expressive and effective. It's a religion that talks about speaking in tongues and healings. That appealed to many young people who came out of the hippie movement and believed in an expressive faith. So there was a time when Eastern gurus like the Maharishi and Meher Baba and many others came to America. It was a time of communes, Moses Burke, Elizabeth Prophet. I mean, many young people were searching and seeking. They felt the times had been disrupted by the Vietnam War, by economic crisis. And the cultural turmoil led to religious experimentation. And much of this religious experimentation ended up in a conservative religious environment because many of those young people who were seeking and became Christians or Jesus freaks, along with many of the young people who were already in conservative churches and wanted to adopt certain countercultural aspects of the Jesus freak movement because, you know, it looked cool to wear pea jackets or grow your hair or listen to rock music. Those two movements converged and created a large baby boom conservative Christian evangelical culture. And that was important for Reagan because it became his ground of support. Is that clear?
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
No, that's incredibly helpful to understand, as you said, both elements of it. There is an existing network and community that someone like Reagan can draw on, and it needs to be someone like Reagan. The fact that, you know, his personal side of it is an important connection to this. It clearly, from that answer, you know, not any presidential candidate would be able to do what he did with it. The personal side is a key aspect as well. So thank you for taking us through kind of those two parts of it. I want to add in a third actor, if we can. We've talked about Reagan. We've talked about kind of changes in religion. Can we talk about changes in the media industry in the 1980s and what impact this had on Reagan getting his message out?
There were a couple of important changes in the news media industry in the 80s. So the first was economic. Up through the 1970s, a large part of the American news media was in family hands. It was families who had owned newspapers or television stations for several generations. There were laws that said once third generation came around, increased taxes would need to be paid on the properties. And so beginning in the 1970s and 80s, many of the media barons, the families that owned large, successful news properties, began deciding to sell because they did not want to have to pay the large taxes that were facing them. And so many local, small, regional newspapers that went from private hands to and were bought up by newspaper chains like Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T, Knight Ritter, Gannett, McClatchy, and others. There were, at that point of time in the 80s, there were several large news chains that were interested in buying up properties. So that was a big difference because a local ownership is usually more invested in their community, in local news, in making sure that the community is serviced by their papers. Once chains buy up papers, there's less interest in serving a community and more interest in thinking about how do we make profits. How do we make profits? Maybe we cut some of the local coverage. Maybe we use more wire service. Maybe we centralize news gathering and distribute from one paper to another. So the fact that papers were becoming parts of news chains impacted the kind of coverage they were able to do and the ways they serviced their audience. They also became, because of their ownership, more invested in profit making. It wasn't as if families weren't interested in profit making, but chains, especially when they were public, needed to satisfy stockholders. And it was interesting because until that time, most Wall Street did not realize how valuable and how profitable news was, but it quickly became apparent that news was a very good business investment. So on the one hand, you have the consolidation of news media outlets. On the other hand, you have the growth of new services that try to serve the entire country, not just certain regions. It's hard to remember, but in the 1980s, the New York Times was not a national paper. The only national paper really was the Wall Street Journal. And that was because technology did not allow, the technology wasn't there to make it easy for a paper to be nationwide. USA Today was a real game changer in that sense. It saw itself as a national newspaper. Not only did it see itself as a national newspaper, it saw itself as a newspaper for the television age. As early as the 1960s, television in America surpassed newspapers as the largest, as having the largest news audience. Even though more people watched television, newspapers were still seen as a more comprehensive news venue because there was more room to develop stories. There were more reporters. And they, you know, it seemed like newspapers often were more intellectual than television news. So USA Today, realizing that television was a popular media, knowing that it wanted to appeal to a large audience, in other words, all the American people, made itself as close to television as a newspaper could be. And at that time, even the newspaper boxes on the streets that sold USA Today looked like television sets. USA televisionized itself. That's a new word I made up, by using lots of color, short stories, bright stories, happy stories. It wanted to tell good news. It wanted to tell the good news that people were looking for. Now, these two vectors, the consolidation of news and the impact of USA Today on the news industry, both benefited Reagan. Benefited Reagan because USA Today saw itself as delivering a message of hope, which is exactly what Ronald Reagan saw himself doing. He saw himself bringing hope to a nation that had been rocked by Watergate, by the Vietnam War, by oil embargoes, by stagflation, by the Iran hostage crisis. He wanted, his whole message was one of hope, which hit very nicely into USA Today's idea of short, snappy, hopeful, colorful news gathering. It also fit into the idea of news consolidation because he was able to reach more newspapers through fewer reporters. And those newspapers also wanted news that was more upbeat than they had in the past, precisely because Americans were so dispirited and news publishers knew they had to begin delivering somewhat more happy, bright fare in order to keep their audiences. So I would say that the 1980s was a real pivotal time for the newspaper business because fewer people were making the decisions, and many of the decisions they made spoke to Reagan's vision of promoting morning in America, as Reagan's commercial once said, a time where we were coming together, where things were getting better, and where we could all be more hopeful.
That's incredibly helpful to understand. I think often we might be aware of some of those changes kind of on a practical level, like, oh, that's when a bunch of big companies bought them up. But to think through sort of what are the implications of that and how does it connect with this message that Reagan is promoting is really helpful to put together. Is there anything further we should understand you'd like to tell us about kind of this combination of things? You've spoken about the religious imagery that Reagan is promoting. You've talked about kind of the context of religion more broadly, about what's happening in the media industry. Is there anything further you want to say on kind of why audiences were so receptive to this message?
Well, thank you, Miranda, because there is something which I neglected to say which is very important for understanding the way Reagan was covered at this time, was told to me by one of my colleagues who was working at Time magazine in this period, in 1980, when Reagan was first running for president, that reporters at Time were told by the head of the magazine, when they asked him about how to think about their coverage of Reagan, they were told that they, i.e. the media, had already destroyed three presidents, and so this one would get a break. In other words, the media helped bring down Nixon, Ford, and Carter through their reporting, but lest they seem too powerful to most readers, they would give Reagan a pass. And this explains a lot, because many observers have wondered why the coverage of Reagan, especially in the early years, was tamer than it had been for previous presidents. There was a lot that was going on that could be scrutinized, criticized, but it wasn't. And Reagan himself was portrayed by the press as this genial, affable, you know, fatherly figure who, you know, said the cutest things. And when he made slip ups or gaffes, it was just, ha ha, you know, that's Reagan. So the mood of the press, I had spoken previously about the press wanting to convey a happier, more hopeful time to its audience, which was good for business. Reagan himself began to fit into this notion just in the way he was covered and the way he wasn't, the press wasn't antagonistic to him initially, which isn't to say that he got a free ride and everybody was, you know, falling all over him. You know, there was criticism of things he was doing, but it wasn't an all-out effort to discredit him or to point out all the mistakes he had made. So, yes, I think that's also very important when one thinks about what was going on. Equally important is to remember at this period in time, the 1980s, there was very much a sense of the elite media, which was the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, Time Magazine, Newsweek, CBS News, very much a sense of the elite media driving media narratives. I experienced this myself when on a papal trip around the country, I literally watched reporters from those papers gather together, huddle together, and decide what the story of the day was. In other words, given all they had heard, what did they agree would be the most important news angle or news stories to give to their editors? Now, they all did it differently, so it didn't seem like there was collusion, but all the stories were basically about the same thing. And the fact that they said this was what the story was made it very difficult to tell other stories, as I myself learned when I wrote a story that was different than the story that came out on the wires from the Times and the Post. And my national editor asked me why my story didn't agree with what the elites were saying. And so there was pressure from the elite news that set the agenda on how to cover things. And so if they were going light on Reagan, other people would go light on Reagan.
No, that's a really helpful additional aspect, and especially your own direct experience of it to understand, because it's one thing to, of course, kind of say something, but then to understand how it's put into practice is key as well. And so speaking of that idea, can I ask you to tell us about kind of something that Reagan did in terms of putting these messages into practice? Not quite yet on policy, I suppose we'll get there. But one thing you talk about in the book is that he does a lot of integrating kind of these secular news narratives that you've discussed, sort of the elite media putting together, with these religious imaginary messages, with specifically evangelical messages. The example, of course, that caught my attention was the Evil Empire speech. That's obviously quite iconic. But I'm wondering if you can explain kind of how he's doing this and with what impact.
Because Reagan saw politics not only as politics per se, but also as something that was inflected by religious ideas and ideals, he often looked at, it's hard for me to talk about this without talking about policy, Miranda.
Because, no, then bring in policy, please.
There was very little daylight between one and the other. And to me, that's most clear in his attitude toward welfare. As soon as he became governor of California, Reagan, which I believe was 1966, Reagan said welfare was among the number one problems in the state, and he wanted to solve it. He felt too much money was going towards welfare, and he wanted to cut back, to cut taxes for one thing, but also because he felt welfare encouraged, welfare did not allow people to take responsibility for their own lives. And he felt that part of being a free people and a people blessed by God was being responsible for your own life. And so by removing people from the welfare rolls, he was doing a religious, following a religious idea of spreading individual freedom and individual responsibility, because you cannot have freedom without responsibility. So welfare, which many Americans had understood as a way to help those who were in need and who needed help, Reagan kind of turned that idea on its head by saying welfare was not helping those people. It was actually taking away their freedom and taking away their opportunity to be good, God-fearing citizens. So to me, that's a very good example of how the politics and the religion came together as sort of a lived religion, because when Reagan instituted welfare cuts, the idea was to get people to find jobs and, you know, work out their marriages and to become stronger, more stable families. It also did cut taxes for many people, and it was a simpler argument and a more understandable argument, especially for people who didn't share Reagan's religious views, to say it's important to cut taxes. But there was always the second side to it, which was the side of the religious imaginary, of living one's freedom as fully as possible.
Mm. No, thank you for taking us through that. And I think the point is well taken, right? How intertwined the ideas and the policy are. And it's not just in domestic issues. Can you talk perhaps about the role of the conflict in Grenada and how this plays into these things being intertwined?
Well, it helps then to go back one step to the Evil Empire. Reagan, in his March 8th, 1983 speech to the National Association of Evangelicals, spoke about an evil empire. At the time, most reporters were, you know, bewildered by that terminology and really did not report it in great detail, maybe, you know, throwing it in their story as an afterthought. But the Evil Empire speech has become one of the most studied, reviled, lauded, all over the map political speeches in America. And that's because Reagan used this very strong religious metaphor to talk about a geopolitical problem. Basically, Reagan hated communism. He always hated communism. He hated communism because it was a threat to democracy, to economic freedom, and to religious freedom. These three freedoms were fundamental to Reagan's religious imaginary: the freedom to be economically free, the freedom to be politically free, and the freedom to be religiously free. And communism endangered all of them. And so that's why in this speech, he referred to communism to the Soviet Union as an evil empire. Now, he said this in the context of the nuclear freeze movement. In the early 1980s, US and USSR were engaged in a battle over weaponry and over nuclear weaponry in specific. And even though arms talks were supposed to be going on, there was conflict between the two sides that stalled the talks, which meant the public was very fearful that a nuclear attack could take place at any time. And in protest, a million people gathered in Central Park to protest. They gathered in London. There were gatherings all over the world of people calling on Reagan to re-enter the disarmament talks and to, you know, call a nuclear freeze. In other words, stop building nuclear weapons. One of the reasons Reagan was so unpopular at the start of 1983 was exactly this. Everyone, Wall Street, Main Street, religious groups, labor groups, poor people, rich people, were very much in favor of a nuclear freeze, which Reagan wouldn't do because he saw the Soviet Union as an evil empire, and all he wanted to do was to end it. So when he called the Soviet Union an evil empire, he put in the minds of many of his listeners, especially the evangelical ones, that the Soviet Union was not just a political threat, it was an existential threat. It was a threat that went to the very heart of the American dream, the American vision. And so the worst thing possible in Reagan's mind was anything that perpetuated, assisted, made this communist evil empire more of a threat to America. That was the context for the fall of 1983, when a coup in Grenada, which is a small Caribbean nation, replaced one communist dictator with an even more rabid communist dictator. And the United States, Reagan's administration, did not want another strong communist government in our hemisphere. Cuba was enough. Cuba was more than enough. And so what Reagan did and did successfully was to link Grenada and this coup with the communist forces in Russia and North Korea and Cuba. And he told the American people that the U.S. needed to launch a mission to Grenada to topple the communist coup and to end the involvement of the Soviet Union, Cuba, North Korea in Grenada. Reagan told the American public there were thousands of troops from Cuba. The Soviet Union was building up the air bases so large planes could come in and out more quickly, and that there was a cache of weapons that were ready to be launched at the United States and other Caribbean nations if the communists were allowed to continue in Grenada. And so Grenada all of a sudden became an example of the evil empire in our hemisphere that was endangering American freedom. And Reagan used this to justify an invasion, though he'd never called it an invasion, of Grenada. And his administration decided that the press would not accompany the fighters. This was the first time in over 100 years that the American press was not allowed to do war coverage, that they were not embedded with the military. In fact, they were forced to stay on Barbados, a nearby island, and were sidelined while the administration told the American people, told the news outlets what was going on. And the administration said that there were many soldiers, many heavy battles, many weapons, many plans to spread communism that they had captured, stopped, defeated. When reporters were finally allowed to go to Grenada, they saw that a lot of this wasn't true, that there weren't that many weapons, there was not evidence of that many soldiers, there was just not the large existential threat that the administration had reported. Yet, by that time, Reagan's vision, Reagan's message of what happened in Grenada had already spread to the public. Reagan promoted this as a big win for America. We defeated communism. We stopped the Soviet Union. We stopped the evil empire. And it gave Americans, many Americans, such a feeling of strength and optimism, a belief in the military that had been shattered after the loss in Vietnam, that it became for many a source of patriotism. The fact that much of it wasn't true didn't catch on. You know, the narrative was already set. And so this is a great example of how Reagan's vision of the evil empire and the policies that he believed would stop it were enacted and explained to Americans and ended up as a way for them to believe more in their vision, believe more in the importance of their God-given freedom and democracy, and also feel better about themselves as Americans, which realistically, after the Iranian hostage crisis, the loss in Vietnam, different events in the Middle East, you know, all these things conspired against a sense of patriotism that Reagan was able to fuel through the Grenada War.
Thank you for taking us through kind of how all those things come together and were brought together really through those different moves of kind of where the journalists were and how all the pieces came together. Can I ask you to talk about one more area of Reagan's sort of rhetoric and policy combined, the framing of poverty and kind of the impact that this had on people's conceptions and narratives?
Yes. That is one of the more distressing aspects of this whole story. A lot of it's distressing, but that in particular. Remember, I had talked earlier about Reagan's linkage of welfare and taxes and how he felt that by lowering taxes, he was also able to impact the problem he thought of welfare. Many of Reagan's cuts in government social services were not only to welfare, but were also to everything from school lunch programs, school bus programs, transportation for the elderly, a wide range of federal programs that helped white, blacks, Asians, Latinos, young, old. They hit a lot of people. And as Americans began realizing the impact of these cuts and the effect they would have on their daily lives, they began to get upset. And so what the administration did was to pivot from having discussions, having reporting on the Asian grandmother who couldn't get, you know, bus fare to visit her grandchildren, or the white, poor white school child who wasn't getting his food, lunch provided. Rather than focus on that, it focused in on Black recipients of welfare. And this was a really strategic move to both racialize and gender social services in general, but welfare in specific. Reagan had signaled this much earlier before he was president by talking about a quote, welfare queen in Chicago who scammed the government thousands of dollars. He talked about young bucks who were what he was referring to Black men who he felt scammed the system. So he had a history of using racialized language to talk about people who he felt were unfairly using welfare and other social services. But at the end of the 80s, as these issues began to loom large in the public's eye, he sort of doubled down on it. And so he began talking, he and his administration began talking more about welfare cheaters, welfare chiselers, and news outlets began to report on welfare having a human face, and that human face was usually Black and it usually was female. And the idea became, the idea circulated was that our tax money is going to help Black women who are single mothers by choice and who don't want to work. That wasn't an accurate narrative for many, many reasons. And yet there's enough free-floating racism and sexism in American society that when reports began to document cases of this, it was easy for many people to believe it and see the tax breaks as a good thing, which were going to make these people take responsibility for themselves.
Mm. And unfortunately, some of these narratives are not necessarily gone today, or still have legacies that carry on from that time. I wonder if maybe you could speak to that, what some of the long-term consequences are of these Reagan policies and rhetoric that you're describing.
Oh, Miranda, I mean, our current national crisis owes everything or owes most of its genesis to Reagan. That's why I think this book, I don't mean to sound self-aggrandizing, but that's why I think this book is important, because I think you cannot understand the present without understanding the past. And the shift in the American religious imaginary to one of individual freedom, both whether economic, political, or religious, speaks to where we are today. We live in a country where personal freedom is seen as paramount, to the point that it totally trumps any kind of communal responsibilities we have to each other or to the rest of the world. We live in a time of economic freedom, which translates as make as much money as you want, screw everyone else in the process, don't pay your workers a living wage. You are allowed to become as rich as you want, not pay any taxes, and pay your workers, pennies. We live in a time of religious freedom, which conservatives refer to as soul liberty, which means you can decide you don't want to make a wedding cake for a gay couple, or you don't want to service trans people. And you can do it because you have the religious freedom, or what they call soul liberty, to do so. So all of these ideas of the imaginary that Reagan perpetuated have had devastating consequences on our country's polity, on its economy, and on its social bond. I don't talk about it much in the book, but in his second term, Reagan got rid of the Fairness Doctrine. The Fairness Doctrine said that television and radio needed to air opposing points of view. So if I got on the radio and said prayer in school was great and we should reinstitute it for XYZ reasons, someone else would have to come on and say why they disagreed with me. Or if I said why I thought abortion had to be ended, someone else would get on and oppose me. When Reagan got rid of the Fairness Doctrine, it opened the path for talk radio, the talk radio we have today, for incendiary, fabricated fake news talk radio, conservative talk radio and television. Fox News would not be possible. Rush Limbaugh, Sean O'Hannity, all these people could never have gotten platforms if the Fairness Doctrine had not been revoked. So Reagan's legacy, to me, is one of a world where Donald Trump can come to power, where billionaires can set our agenda, where regular working people feel utterly alienated from their country, where Blacks and whites, Jews and Christians, Muslims and Christians, where all groups feel polarized. So these policies live on in our world today in the most detrimental way imaginable.
Definitely not the most optimistic note to end on, but I think in some ways the most important.
Yeah. And I have to say, I don't think Reagan would have wanted this. I don't think that Reagan would have liked to see the threats to democracy that we live with today. I think it's because oftentimes we live in a world of unintended consequences. I don't think Reagan would have ever supported Donald Trump. For all his faults, Reagan believed in democracy and he believed in the United States, which is what a lot of current Trump supporters, it's a belief that a lot of current Trump supporters do not share. On a happier note, I think one of the things the book does show is that things change and other ideologies, other imaginaries are possible. One of the reasons I wrote the book was because when I started in 2008, Obama had been elected, and I thought he was going to be a person who would change the imaginary. I thought his speeches about hope and change would unite the country into a more communitarian, egalitarian way of looking at the world. Unfortunately, that did not happen. And instead, Trump has become the person who is changing the vision and the ideology. But it is possible that there is someone out there who can help set a new agenda for us.
Yeah, who knows what the future might hold. Exactly. That's, in fact, the point of my final question I'd like to ask, less on a kind of national political level, if you don't mind, but still on the idea of what the future might hold. This book, obviously, as you said, is something you've been working on for a while, but it is out now. People can go read it and read all the details. So is there anything you might be working on now that it's done, whether or not it's a book, whether or not it's on this exact topic that you'd like to share?
Thank you for asking that. A lot of what I'm doing these days is trying to get the book in people's hands. It's not because I'm looking to make a big windfall from it, but I think that its messages about politics, religion, and the news media are so germane today as well. I mean, the news media is very different in 2024 than it was in 1983. It's much more diffuse and it's much more siloed at the same time. But it has had an equally problematic effect on our social dynamics and on our political state. And you need to look no further than the war in Gaza to see that. I don't know how anyone knows what is actually going on there, because there are so many narratives that are being imposed by the people and organizations which are supposed to be reporting news to us. Same thing with the Trump-Biden race here in America. I mean, if you believe the media, Biden has done nothing except age in its last 4 years. And, you know, everything Trump does is newsworthy. So if Trump does manage to win again, I hold the media responsible to a great degree for that by its terrible reporting on the current administration and its pandering to Trump. So for those very reasons, I want to talk about the book as much as possible and try to, you know, engage other Americans to think about how the past reflects on the future and how the problems of the media and, you know, political vision still affect us today. Hmm. So, yeah, that's my current project, making sure in the months up to the election that I can speak as many places to as many people as possible.
Well, best of luck with that. And thank you for allowing us to be one of the people you speak to. This is a good point to remind listeners that, of course, they can read the whole book titled Writing the American Dream, How the Media Mainstreamed Reagan's Evangelical Vision, published by the University of Chicago Press. Diane, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Oh, Miranda, thank you for giving me my own bully pulpit.